Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Welcome along to the Sunday Paper Review. We are joined in studio by David Snaid, football journalist. We also have Hugh Farley with us, deputy head of sport at the Mail on Sunday and the Irish Daily Mail, and obviously a man you'll know for his rugby coverage as well. I'll go through the back pages to kick things off. Liverpool, as you might imagine, are on lots of the back pages. Firm grip on the title, as has been the case for some time now. Best start ever to Premier League has Liverpool 16 points clear at top. The picture is of Robert Firmino after his goal against Spurs yesterday evening, a 1-0 win for Liverpool. The Star go with the same story, specialist in winning, but record-breaking Klopp not interested. This is Jurgen Klopp, who's not overly bothered by the record that they've set. And fill your boots, Guardiola, Foden our next Silva. David Silva set to leave Man City at the end of the season. Guardiola saying he's not going to go into the market for a replacement because he has Phil Foden. Back page of the Sun, top left corner, we have a picture of Harry Kane on his hospital bed after his surgery. Bed rest, Kane on the mend, Harry Kane braced to start his recovery from yesterday's surgery on his ruptured left hamstring. And then beneath that, Reds best, Klopp's men break Euro points record. Sunday Mirror Sport, Guardiola, Foden our new Silva, again a similar theme. Phil Foden to take over from David Silva in Guardiola's eyes. And Van de Bleek, Ajax star off to Real Madrid for £46 million after Reds Chiefs pulled plug on cut price £20 million deal. Manchester United says Simon Mullock could have had Donny van de Beek for £20 million. He's now off to Real Madrid for £46 million. Then the Sunday Independent, a few things here. Picture of Firmino again, Liverpool looking invincible as they edge closer to the title. And a picture of Desi Farrell on the bottom of the front page. Farrell's fledgings narrowly defeated in New Dawn, a 1-point loss to Longford yesterday, although really it was, depending on which piece you read, something approaching a D or E team for Dublin. Back page of the Mail on Sunday, 16 points clear, 38 games unbeaten. Liverpool are record breakers is the back page. And then a story we'll come to in just a moment. Toner dismisses Schmidt's World Cup, quote, excuse. Devin Toner has been speaking to the Sunday Papers today. And the Sunday Times then, again, it's Robert Firmino, record breakers, 16 points clear at the top of the table. 61 Euro points landmark for first 21 top flight games. Nobody in the top five leagues has hit 61 points for 21 top flight games. And it is now 374 days since their last Premier League defeat. And again, that Devon Toner story, Toner unimpressed by Schmidt, excuse on World Cup omission. So Devon Toner, Hugh, has spoken at last, really. It's the first time we've heard him speaking about his omission from the World Cup. And he's in all the papers, Shane McGrath there in the back page of the Mail. Brendan Fanning has it. I have Peter O'Reilly here. They all take a very similar theme, as you might imagine, and they go back to the moment Devon Toner found out he wouldn't be going to the World Cup. Peter O'Reilly writes, Devon Toner was watching TV with his wife when Joe Schmidt called. It was Sunday evening, September the 1st, the night before the World Cup announcement. The dreaded call, as it's described here, is what Toner received. I was just on the couch, he said, with Mary. His name came up. I showed it to her and I was like, what's this? I went to the kitchen, I took the phone call, and that was it. I went back in, and she couldn't believe it either. It was more shock the first night. The next day, it started eating away at me. People would probably say I'm quite level-headed off the field as well. I probably take things in my stride. A bit too much, probably, people would say. But obviously, I was disappointed. Like, I was bitterly, bitterly disappointed. I suppose it was probably anger for a day or two as well, but I got over it. It sunk in, and I had to move on. Says that his wife or his partner, Mary, was a bit angrier than me. I was telling her to calm down. I didn't vent. I texted a couple of people. I let it fester for a few days. And ultimately, he says that he didn't put any stock, really, in Schmidt's version of events. Schmidt wrote about how one of the key reasons, if not the key reason, that Toner was omitted was a fear of an imminent sighting. Toner says this is an excuse, frankly. So he says, where's the exact quote? I was pretty confident going, probably a bad thing as well. I should have been kept on my toes a bit more maybe, but I thought I was going. I wasn't 100% confident. And he says, the conversation that I had with Joe was I wasn't going because they needed a tight head lock and I didn't show enough in the preseason games. Coming to the tail end of the conversation, he mentioned something about a high hit, but like he never used it as an excuse that I wasn't going or why I wasn't getting picked. So when I saw that assertion, to me, that's maybe an excuse. When Joe mentioned it, I didn't know what he was talking about. I didn't even remember a tackle. Mm.
Farley's getting angry here.
Yeah, I do get angry. Like this was a massive shock, obviously, but and a colossal error by Schmidt, I think. To the point where I would say bringing John Klein instead of Devin Toner was the equivalent of England taking Sam Burgess to the last World Cup. Yeah. I think it was that kind of decision.
It was the poster boy selection, wasn't it?
Yeah, he's become a kind of a figurehead for everything excuse me, that went wrong, Klein has. Now, like Brendan, Peter and Shane, all very experienced, all know their business, and they've all done a nice job on Devin Toner, but he says it himself that he's very level-headed, and this for him, you know, he normally doesn't give a whole lot away, this for him is very reasoned, but it's still for him is dynamite, like what he's saying here, he's basically dismissing the reasons that Schmidt gave him or gave for his exclusion, specifically
the fear of the sighting,
which,
yeah.
I mean, as somebody made the point, one of the lads made the point that, you know, why not pick him anyway? And if he is sighted, replace him. Do you know what I mean? There was no reason not to pick him. And the reasons given, even aside from the sighting reason, the tight head lock thing does my head in. Do you know? Devin Toner was there for how many years under Schmidt? And the scrum wasn't an issue. And all of a sudden, you know, this notion that you have to be a specialist to push behind a tight head. The scrum lives or dies by your tight head prop, the front row. Mm-hmm. Second rows, you know, don't get any credit if it goes well, and they get blamed if it goes badly. But like, that's not enough a reason to bring a guy ahead of someone like Toner. I think there's a kind of a tremendous goodwill towards Toner, and even reading these pieces, you can sense it coming across. He's a very likable guy. He's like an ordinary guy who happens to be, you know, he's enormous, like he's 6'11". Mm. He's had a lifetime of people saying, what's the weather like up there? And, you know, he's quite reserved on the back of it. I remember interviewing him actually years ago. It was 2008, I think, because you try and get the young fellas on the way up. Mm. And I'd seen him play for Lansdowne in the AIL, and you could just see he was, but the way he's changed over the years in his style, when he started out, his height made him an easy target. He used to crumple in contact and stuff. Mm-hmm. And he worked so hard on his game to be more than a line-out guy. And Schmidt did a lot of that work. And then to just yank it away from him at the last minute, you know, it was brutal.
Hmm. Like, it was done on a phone call.
Yes, yeah, the night before.
Like, so you would think for a manager who's worked with a player like that and who's, like, being on a news desk as a sub-editor, like, Toner is always one of these players who's put up for an interview because he's, like, so steady. Like, he's, the amount of interviews with Devin Toner that have subbed, it's incredible. Like, he's always put up. I just can't believe that Schmidt didn't have the courtesy to actually do a face-to-face.
Well, I guess maybe there's a lot going on and he's got lots of people to call. Like, the thing is, Schmidt's been accused of being too loyal to players.
Yeah.
Not according to Devin Toner.
He was the last person you'd see. Okay, his form in the pre-World Cup, you know, the Mickey Mouse game, so hot, you know? Mm. This was the cornerstone. He was there for all the big days. The All Blacks wins, South Africa, he was there for all of them, the Grand Slam. Like, and the other aspect to it, and I, you know, this is a bugbear of mine, I don't want to go down there too much, but who replaced him? A guy who qualified a couple of weeks beforehand, you know, parachuted in. I mean, there's all kinds of strands to that. You know, we don't pick Simon Zeebo or Dominic O'Ryan because they're not there for the preparation. If you pick a guy who lands in, you know, a few weeks beforehand, there's a hypocrisy there. Mm. But that side of it is interesting because, you know, Toner's very popular. There's, you know, we saw against Japan and the All Blacks at the World Cup, was there a psychological issue, a morale issue? Mm. I wonder the impact of Toner's dropping, what it had on the squad and the team room. I imagine it wasn't great. And, you know, and the losing a guy who'd been there for years like that, I just think it will go down as the big black mark on Schmidt's tenure.
Is there an argument that Joe Schmidt didn't want to come out publicly and say, I've looked at Devin Toner, he's not playing well enough in the pre-season matches and I'm worried about his contribution in the scrum, therefore, publicly at least and in my book, I'm going to inflate my worries over this sighting for the Rob Evans tackle to protect Toner's reputation. And that actually, that by doing all that publicly, Schmidt might have felt, well, he wasn't throwing Devin Toner and his next contract negotiation and everything else. He wasn't throwing Toner under the bus. He was trying to be as kind as possible publicly, and that actually showed a certain loyalty.
Possibly, but it's very hard. Like, you don't want to put yourself inside Joe Schmidt's head, but I certainly took it as, after the fact, a way of justifying his decision. Mm. And that's how Devin Toner takes it, based on the quotes today. I think he got it wrong, and this was a way of explaining it. But, you know, maybe he was trying to protect Devin, but...
Because he told Toner the truth. I mean, if we're taking the, you know, if we take Toner's recollection of the phone call as read, he is saying to him on the phone that he wasn't good enough in the pre-season games, that they needed a tight head lock. That is Schmidt's rationale. Now, publicly, he talks about the sighting. But clearly, he's given Toner the honest reason.
I think it's the theme of the year, and you've talked about it on this programme before. I think Schmidt panicked as the year went on. And he thought, we're heading for South Africa in the quarterfinal, we need beef. Mm. And I think that was the reason he took Klein. And he went away from something that had worked for him for how many years, you know? So, the good news is that Tone has responded brilliantly. He's playing really well this year. And like, what is he, 33? But he says himself in the pieces, he's in the shape of his life. So, you know, there is a bit of a bounce back story here, hopefully, because I mean, you just want him to do well. And you always feel more confident with Ireland run out if he's there.
Mm. Today against Lyon, by the way, and various journalists point this out today, his 243rd Leinster cap, so he's just 15 appearances away from breaking Gordon Darcy's all-time record, which is quite some achievement. His last Central IRFU contract is up at the end of the season. Ronan O'Gara was in touch, he was saying as well, when he got the bad news. Who did I talk to? Obviously my wife. I got one of the best texts from Rog. Ronan O'Gara sent me a really, really nice text. That was unexpected. It meant a good bit to me. It was basically, don't let it define you as a player. You've loads of years left. Don't let this define you. Move on. I felt that was really good from him. And then all his contemporaries texted him as well. Where are you in the Joe Schmidt legacy as we put 2019?
Yeah, I was just talking to David outside. I mean, I'd be a huge admirer of Joe Schmidt and all he's done for Irish rugby, but it's just, it's blow after blow after blow now. Do you know, the book went down very badly. Well, not off the shelves where it's been romping, but it just seems to be, you know, the way he's handled the fallout from the World Cup hasn't done him any favours. We've Rory Best's book coming out. That whole Rory Best Schmidt back and forth was a bit unseemly as well. So I think history would be a lot kinder to Joe Schmidt. I think they look back at his overall contribution and remember that. But at the moment, we're still very raw from the World Cup, and the way he's, you know, he had to do a book tour. You know, a guy who shies away from the media, as by definition, all of a sudden he's popping up on. Mm. You know, Loose Women and all, you know, Born in Ireland, whatever, he was everywhere. And, you know, it came across badly, I thought, now. But he's still, like, he's a genuinely decent bloke, and I just don't think that suited him. And I think his legacy, unfortunately, has been tarnished, at least in the short term.
So, in short, on the Toner situation, if he had just come out and said, look, I want more beef in my pack, and I want a tight headlock specialist, that would have been the way to go.
There's no viable reason Joe Schmidt could have given for leaving Toner out. I don't believe, like, people look at us outside and, you know, what do you know, whatever, we're inside. But this is, like, Ronan O'Gara texts him. They wouldn't be natural mates. You know, Toner might have been there at the end of Ronan's career. But this was an insult to Irish rugby. It was an insult. Like, this affected people all the way down, coaches around the country, small clubs, parachuted in South African with flimsy reasons. It was just and. You know, Joe maybe didn't get that. He does know Irish rugby. He's been here long enough. He was involved in Mullingar and stuff. But this was a blow to the gut of the game in this country. Like that, I don't want to over-egg it, but like, that's how big a decision it was. You know,
And not vindicated given Klein's performance at the World Cup.
And then we see what happened. Klein was putrid at the World Cup.
He played against Russia. Was about the height of it, wasn't it?
And he was lumbering around the place. Now look, I've no Klein for Munster, no issue. Like, he's played well for Munster. He's a big lump, puts himself about. I have a major issue with him playing for Ireland, but he didn't produce at the World Cup. So ultimately, you know, the decision wasn't vindicated, as you said.
Okay. Well, Devon Toner's across the papers, and as you said, he's a very reasoned fella. This is the equivalent of Devon Toner tearing off his T-shirt Hulk style, is it? That's the level of dynamite we've got here.
An image.
And it's still quite.
You'd just be rooting for him, you know. I just he's a really good guy and a hell of a player.
Can we turn to your piece on Munster, page 74 and 75 of the Mail on Sunday, because this is quite damning of Johan van Graan, really. And we're talking in advance of the Racing match. I know lots of people will probably come to this on Monday after the results.
Yeah.
But regardless, you're standing over what you found here.
Yeah.
The vibe in Munster, not good.
Well, it stems from, as you say, they could go out and do a Munster on Racing against the odds, you know, one of their famous back against the wall. They have a history of that. It's just in the wake of the defeat up in Ulster, which was humiliating. I just rang around, you know, you'd have people who would be close to the camp that you ring to get what's going on. I just thought that was such a shocking performance. Now, admittedly, they're missing a chunk of guys that are playing against Racing. So, you know, you judge it that way. But there was, I mean, you've seen all the Munster players come out in the aftermath of that match talking about, you know, where was the dog, where was the traditional stuff. And when you ring around and you dig down, there are issues there. I mean, this identity crisis thing has been knocking around for a while, both in terms of their style of play. You know, traditionally Munster were always direct, aggressive, and took it from there. And you knew what you were getting, but you couldn't stop it. Now there's uncertainty. And the word coming back on van Graan, who everybody likes, he's a very personable guy. The media like him. You know, he does this thing at press conferences where he shakes hand of everyone, which think people put too much importance on things like that, but it works. I mean, he hasn't got a kick in so far to any degree. But the word is that he comes from a background of analysis, you know, laptop, you know, studying all the moves and all that, and he's very good at it, and he had a reputation with the Bulls in South Africa on that basis. And the word is that his coaching is very scattered, is the word it was described to me as, that people come out of it kind of going, well, what exactly are we doing here? And that, you know, that's, I'm just relaying what I was told, and when you look at them on the pitch, like against Ulster, they were all over the shop, you know, they didn't know what they were doing, whereas Ulster were very direct, so there's that side to it. I also heard that he's only a young fella. Like he got the job at 37, I think. He doesn't turn 40 till March. That's young, coaching wise. Players are only a few years younger than him, and he's said to be, you know, very maybe not in awe of, but like influenced by the senior guys in the Munster squad. You know, the older guys and younger players. And I know this from direct information that they feel he's been promising game time that he hasn't delivered on, things like that. So there's that side to it. So,
and if you were winning, that's the kind of complaint that would be typical of any province. The younger players feel they're not getting their chance. Michael Checa, Johnny Sexton, is par for the course. But when you're not winning, those kind of
all
foibles
these things
look worse.
Like they win today and maybe it could turn around, but there's a lot of stuff going on. And in terms of, he's been there a while now, and you look at Dan McFarland, what he's doing up in Ulster, Leo Cullen, Stuart Lancaster, Leinster, Andy Friend at Connacht, they're struggling at the moment because of injuries, but you know who's the boss. Van Grand doesn't feel like it's my team, I'm the man in charge. You know, he's got two big names underneath him now in Rowntree and Larkham. I think coming out and saying I need more time wasn't the strongest move when you're there in your third season, do you know? I don't want to damn the guy. I mean, it's just, there's a lot of disquiet on the ground. I'd be kind of close to the club game in Munster, and they just don't see it there at all. You know, there's a kind of a disconnect there, which relates into the other issue of identity in terms of the amount of imports they're relying on now and stuff. So it's shaky enough, I think, down there.
So you say, I mean, in your piece, you talk about still young in coaching terms. Insiders suggest the head coach over-influenced by senior Munster players only a few years younger than himself. This is a source of frustration for the younger contingent, some of whom believe he's not followed through and talk of greater frontline exposure. You talk about that detail as well, and the scattered word appears here. You say that clarity is being lost beneath an avalanche of confusing detail. This would tally with Van Grand's coaching background with the Bulls in South Africa, where he was renowned for his technical analysis in front of the computer more than for his hands-on application on the training park. And then you talk about the identity. Munster have moved too far away from their representative past. You talk about the era of O'Connell, O'Gara, Stringer, Quinlan, Foley, host of others. That core still exists in the likes of O'Mahony, Murray, Earl, Scannell, and several more key figures, but it no longer seems to be the driving force consumed by the flow of imported talent from other provinces, notably Leinster and overseas. A whopping 14 of Munster's Champions Cup squad have been brought in from outside, which compares starkly to the mere 5 outsiders on Leinster's European roster. Indeed, of the 12 Munster players named in Andy Farrell's initial 45-man squad for the Six Nations, only 6 were from the province, with CJ Stander, Jean Klein, Joey Carberry, Conway, Chris Farrell and Mike Haley all imported. Munster have suffered from a below par academy system for too long.
Yeah, now there are, that's improved in terms of some of the talent coming through, the Craig Casey, Finian Richley, these guys. I mean, Jack O'Sullivan's a guy to watch, actually. There's a lot of, you know, all the Caelan Doris, all the Leinster stuff, but he's proper. Like, his dad actually is Tiger O'Sullivan, the Munster doctor, would have been a very good number 8 for Sunday as well back in the day.
So the next 5 years could signal a bit of an upturn.
I hope so, but like you talk about detail there, you know, people I was talking to were Leinster are the obvious comparison, which grates down Munster. I mean, the years of, you know, the relish with which you put Leinster back in their box, because, you know, the fancy boys preening around, and Leinster have got it right so well. I mean, I talked there in the piece about Hugh Hogan, who's would be well known on the club scene as a number 8 for St Mary's. He would have played Leinster A as well. He's a very good player. He's there now as their contact skills coach.
Yeah.
And Munster don't have an equivalent of that, and the players apparently are loving him. It's the minute detail of where you position your body for ruck clearouts, tackles, carries, and you can see it the way Leinster play. As I said in the piece, like the accuracy with which they play, which is missing in Munster. They don't have that. You talk about the academies, what was said to me during the week is that, a small thing, but it is quite stark, is that Leinster have all their coaches on the one floor. All, you know, the offices or the desks are all on the one floor. Munsters are two or three floors apart in their UL base, you know. So there's kind of a collective, excuse me, focus in Leinster that is missing in Munster. And you hope they turn around, but I think there's a disconnect there, and it's worrying because you could always depend, like, people forget that all the provinces, but Munster were a representative team. You know, you came out of the clubs and you played for your province, you were representing your club, family, friends, all that. That seems to be dissipating. And when the pressure comes on, that thing, and it's cliched and all that, the pride and passion stuff, but you know, O'Garan, Quinlan and these boys talk how potent it was, and it just, that seems to be diluted.
And O'Garan, his piece in The Examiner on Friday, talked about how some lads had been thrown into the leadership group at Munster, and really they didn't merit a position there, that they just weren't up to it. Though you can see how, if you're Van Graan reading this, you would think, well, hang on, so you're praising Leinster here for attention to detail and Hugh Hogan and skills coach and all the minutiae working here, and yet I'm being attacked for having too much detail and being a brilliant technical coach. So which is it?
That's a fair point, and I get where you're coming from, but I think it's the focus with which Leinster do it. I think there's system. You know, do you remember when Lancaster came in first, there was all this talk about he was the real coach of Leinster and all this? Like, it's rubbish. Like, Leo, the way they have streamlined the thing is just working beautifully down to that thing. And I think in Munster there's too much. You know, I mean, forwards coach is Rowntree, who's technically a scrum coach. JP Ferreira is a specific defence coach. Larkin's doing the back, so what's Van Graan doing? You know, is he overseeing? What I'm hearing is that there's just a lack of clarity compared to Leinster. And and to go back to the identity thing, like, the Leinster turnaround in that is remarkable. You know, they feel like a team who, they used to also be seen as weak, you know, kind of. Do you remember the mid-2000s when they were blown away in Lansdowne Road? They were soft. Now there's a real, like, you could have 21 players in a squad of 23 from the province, proud to represent the province. And now that it's gone beyond the D4 traditional environs, it's very impressive that bit of, you know, dog is in them, which you saw us be absent, and it's diluting the Munster, which is the concern.
Okay.
Now, listen, I'd love to see them win today, and I'd love to be proven wrong, and, you know, maybe victory could focus the minds and stuff, but this is what I'm hearing from on the ground down there. From
did you speak to senior players?
I can't. That stuff.
Do you get a sense that senior players are happy? Because it's notable the younger players feel they're not getting enough of a chance, which I would suspect is a complaint right across the board.
That's always the way. You're not getting picked. Yeah. You're going to have a pop. Like,
I guess if he loses senior players, then he's in big trouble.
I can't go into, but I do think there's a sense that he's not putting his stamp on the team.
Okay.
Is that the issue? Obviously, looking at this from the outside and just going through what Farrelly's been saying there, you talk about, say, the culture, obviously that's important, but if he's not getting his messages properly across on the training pitch and the players don't actually know exactly what's needed, that's the biggest thing of all, surely.
Yeah.
Like, I know obviously it's important to have that connection with supporters and an understanding, but if any player goes onto a pitch and doesn't know exactly what's needed within the system, that's the most damning thing of all. So he could be good in those technical aspects, but actually getting the message across.
He knows the game. You know, to be fair to him, he's in his first senior head coach role, but he's into the third season. Munster have won the trophy since 2011. These are the guys who were the kings of Irish rugby, European rugby, and now it's pushing 10 years, and this transition has been hanging around, and people are sick of transition. And him coming out saying we need more time, and he does, maybe, like, Larkham and Rowntree bedding in, two lads arriving, South Africans arriving next year, Alende and Snaiman. But, you know, patience is worn thin on the time plea, you know.
Yeah, and the clock is ticking over that generation of O'Mahony and Earls.
Yeah. Oh, God, if you think Peter O'Mahony retires without a medal of any description. Oh, no, he was there in 2011, wasn't he? I think he might have come on after.
On a different aspect for that, and not just saying it because Farrelly's here, but something like that in terms of the rugby, if you're not bang into it and you want to have an understanding, a piece of that is very good, because it's not just you kind of going off and talking about, well, this is what's wrong. You've actually put the work in and spoken.
I couldn't make those claims without talking.
That's
about
because they're big claims.
Yeah,
big
exactly. Claims.
You'd have to. That's what. And, you know, there's the issue of right of reply. Of course, you know,
you'll probably get a phone call.
Well, I'd happily talk to them, but you couldn't get them now in the build-up to a big game or anything. But these are coming. This is coming from people around the camp.
No, it's a sourced piece. It's very clear. So that's in the mail. That's well worth a read. Just to briefly mention before we leave the rugby for a moment, Dennis Walsh on page 8 has a good interview with Jack O'Donoghue, who in the midst of 2 wins in 7 has still managed to play very, very well. Gordon Darcy is quoted in the Dennis Walsh piece. Gordon Darcy in the Irish Times was saying that this is high praise, perhaps too high, but I thought about Rocky Elson watching O'Donoghue in full flow over Christmas. He was the difference in a horrible night in Galway against Connacht. He has always possessed the raw materials to become an established Irish international, or it could go another way. That's up to the man himself. He wasn't in the 45-man stock take, by the way, O'Donoghue, and he talks about that and talks about a bit of anger in his performance against Connacht. It's 2 years since he won his second cap for Ireland. That was on a summer tour of the US and Japan. He did, at the end of that season, injure his knee against Leinster. That put him out for 10 months. So he can cover any position across the back row. He's in his mid-20s. Roy Scannell, the youngest player to reach 100 appearances for Munster, but he beat O'Donoghue by just less than a month. So O'Donoghue has racked up experience, even if he hasn't been recognised really at the international level. He's saying here, Hugh, in previous years, as opposed to this year, I'd get 2 games, then the internationals would come back and I'm on the bench, not involved. You feel a bit sorry for yourself or you feel a bit down. Then you get an opportunity again and you're nervous. I don't want to make a mess of it. That's probably the big difference this season. And then the piece goes on and talks about how as a 14-year-old, really, he was into show jumping. And then he was at De La Salle and he was playing hurling and he's come to rugby quite late. Does he have it within him to get into an Irish Six Nations squad and make an imprint this year?
First of all, do you not think he's the head of David Snaith, though? He's got that kind of rugged boyishness thing going on.
Yes, if you're listening, just imagine David
Snaith. Sorry, apologies.
Not quite the physique of Snaith. Because he wasn't in that 45-man squad, which was
The problem is we are awash, as always, with quality back rows. I mean, there's guys who aren't in the squad as well, like Matty Ray up in Ulster, Paul Boyle, who I think is a superb player and should be up there. Just can't get in because they're just queuing up, mostly from Leinster, to be fair. No, like, to go back to the identity thing briefly, like, he comes from Waterford. Waterford is a remote outpost of Munster rugby. They had a senior club, Water Park, which is his roots.
He says they had 3 in the whole county. Yeah, 3 clubs.
Water Park were, like, I think I remember playing, Ben Cronin used to play for them. He would have got a few caps for Ireland, his number 8. But beyond that, and Greg Toohey was down there, and I think he played a few times for Munster. But we're remote, so to see him come out of there is great. Mm. But he's playing superbly at the moment, and you know, it's a nice interview by Dennis Walsh, and he comes across well, and he has a good attitude. What can he do? He just keeps doing what he can. But I mean, Caelan Doris, Will Connors, now they're all talking about, you know, they're just...
Max Deegan's making a push
Max
again,
Deegan
isn't he?
Playing superbly.
And no one even mentions Dan Levy at the moment.
Levy to come back, you know, it's nuts.
So that's worth reading in the Sunday Times. There are various other pieces. David Walsh is writing about Saracens. Stuart Barnes, by the way, is very excited about what the French have to offer. Neil Francis has a piece on Ulster yesterday. It talks about how once the scrum went, Ulster went, but does say that Cooney is now a better passer as well than Conor Murray and should be in the green shirt against Scotland. So there's lots of rugby coverage. David Snaith, you've been waiting patiently.
Sorry, Dave.
egg-chasing nonsense to be done with.
No, so I feel informed.
Where do you want to go? We have interviews with Jack Woolley. We have Manchester United, Manchester City pieces. There's GAA, Desi Farrell, amongst other things. So we'll give you a choice.
I'm going to go with Jack Woolley in the mail. Mark Gallagher. It's on page 62 and 63.
The most common thing we say on the paper review is that Mark Gallagher has a habit of dreaming up interviews that nobody else seems to have dreamed up, and he's done it again.
I know, and he hasn't. Like, I know from a former colleague of mine, and he's just constant bringing up these very quirky, not so much quirky, but just pieces that are off the beaten track a little bit, I suppose, and just people wouldn't have. Like, I'd never heard of this fella, Jack Woolley.
Woolley or Woolley?
Actually, you know, was it Woolley or
Woolley? I think
Woolley. Yeah. I went down to the garage this morning and bought the papers, and then when you see a kind of promoter on the back, you're sort of wondering, it's obviously a good story. Mm. And then obviously it's like, some opponents won't even shake my hand, so you're like, right, well, what's the piece about? And it's literally, I have it here marked. I literally have nearly every paragraph of the interview marked. It's about 16. You are subbing it, would have 1,700 words.
We had to cut a load out of it, actually. And There was 2,300 words there, and Mark had written 3,500.
So basically, it leads in. So Jack Woolley does not want to be known as the gay fighter. He wants to be known as the lad from Talla who made history by becoming the first Irish person to qualify for the Olympics in Taekwondo. And his kicking back is the headline.
So this is a guy that we're all going to see in Japan. Yeah, as a 17-year-old, he missed out on Rio.
And it was part of an RTE documentary, so like he, it's amazing. So he actually came out on this documentary and said he was bisexual. And he regrets it a little bit. Mm. He says it now that kind of basically he'd only just come out to his parents, and he was kind of, it was coming around the place in Tallaght, and this, he'd obviously come out, but his grandparents still didn't know. It was obviously a great source of anxiety, which you would imagine. So obviously Mark meets him, which is again is another big thing. It's not something that's done over the phone. There's a bit of warmth to this piece as well, which you need when you actually meet someone. And he just said kind of, I just wish I never labelled it. Like, I still don't like labelling it. People are just hell bent on giving everyone labels nowadays. Without quoting directly, he goes, I'm not the Welsh rugby player in brackets Gareth Thomas or the diver Tom Daly. They are big names and people talk about them. But if you notice, I didn't even know his name. He was just a rugby player. I just want to be the first Olympian in my sport. The lad from Tallaght who went to the Olympics, not Jack, the gay athlete. Now you would think that's enough for someone to be contending with that age. He's only just gone 21. Mm. And then you read the rest of the piece and what he's been through in his life with, like, without going through it, because we want people to read it, but stuff with his grandparents, stuff with his own brother, dealing with things with his own parents, then himself. And it's just a story of just amazing perseverance and commitment to his chosen sport, and clearly his way of life. Like, I'm not going to give too much away on it because you really want people to read this, but he's like sacrificed so much from a personal point of view with his own family and missed out on some of the most gut-wrenching occasions of his life to be a part of a sport that some people don't even still accept him in because he's bisexual. And you're like, where this fella gets the actual, just the guts in himself to keep on going and what he's been through. Like, he's been to see a sports psychologist, and you're just like, you want this fella, you just can't wait to see this fella in action. Like, he's going to be the sixth seed. And you just, it's one of those pieces that you kind of, you keep it away, and when the Olympics comes around, you just want this fella to be a star and get the profile he deserves from what he's been through.
And when he does talk about how he doesn't want to be like Gareth Thomas, whereby he says himself, I don't even know Gareth Thomas's name, I just know him as the gay rugby player.
I know, yeah.
I do not want to be the bisexual or the gay taekwondo fighter. I really don't. And yet, you know, it's the hook of the piece as
but
well.
That was the issue, because Mark rang me after. Mark only talked to him on Thursday night, and because we got him late in the week, and
turned it around very well.
He did, and he was working on all day Friday, and he was concerned how we put it across, because he said Jack didn't want, as he says himself, he was reluctant to talk about the sexuality issue, but once he did, he spoke brilliantly and he spoke at length about it. So it would have been wrong to ignore it, you know.
You see, it's not that Jack Woolley can't talk about his sexuality, he can at length. His problem is when he does it, even if he talks brilliantly,
he becomes,
the headline is gay taekwondo fighter at the Olympics.
That's why we tried to get away from the too obvious in headline and stuff, but him, what he said in this piece about you know, battling prejudice and all that would be hugely beneficial. You know, people will take from that, as he says himself, you know, he hopes that, you know, he can be an example or help inspire others. But what struck me, and Mark said it as well when he spoke to him, is that the guy's only 21.
I know.
He comes across as so mature.
Because he could have been at the Olympics at 17. He does say that as a martial art, taekwondo, it's a tough world. And Mark writes, Mark Galler, it's dominated by Muslim athletes. This brings its own issues. He has had opponents refuse to acknowledge him after bouts. Mm. Mm. It is tough, he says, my sport. A lot of the top athletes will be Muslim, so you can't be too open about it. I would have had some opponents who wouldn't shake my hand, and I'm just thinking you need to cop on. Some have, though. One of the top fighters in the world came up to shake my hand after I won the European silver. I appreciated that. Most people don't care, though, and they shouldn't care. It's only if you have a problem with me, then I'll have a problem with you. Maybe it can be good. Maybe I can be an inspiration to some young people. And if someone wants to talk to me about what they're going through, then they can. But I'm not throwing it in your face.
Isn't that brilliant? You know, and like you think, he says that Dave alluded to it there. I think he's been to 43 countries. A lot of the times he's traveling on his own.
Yeah.
He's in these places like Moldova and stuff. You're a kid on your own, and you're getting abused by people for who you are.
Like he misses Nana's funeral.
Yeah.
Just to go to an event that he had to qualify for to make sure that he could still continue, and then he went back just to give a medal he'd won to his ma, so his ma could have it as one of the offerings. So he went home, gave the medal that he'd won, and then had to go off again and miss the funeral. And you're like,
he's a serious young fella.
There's you'll see, I actually marked nearly everything on it, but like one of the passages that I actually, there's a couple of bits that make you laugh. including a very dodgy sauna in Romania. but he mentions about how obviously he goes to the Sport Ireland Institute out in Abbottstown. Mm. And like he's like, so everyone is very friendly out there, but they all have their own groups. There are boxers in one group, swimmers in another, athletics. I'm the only taekwondo player out there, so I'm on my own. Because I do feel more comfortable now than when I first went out there. I was a lot skinnier than I am now. So I was a skinny little kid from transition year, and walking into this room with all these athletes with Olympic tattoos plastered all over themselves, 6'5", ripped, and here was me, a skinny little child, not knowing anyone. Mm. But then he goes, I'm still that skinny kid with no Olympic tattoo, but it was nice the other day, everyone was congratulating me. You're like, man, even dealing with that, when you're in that environment of all these fellas and you see what's, and women as well, but he still had that kind of gumption with himself to actually persevere and not feel overawed too much, where he kept on going. And it's just, reading this piece, it's a kind of a triumph of his own perseverance, but he's still not a kid, he's but he's got so much more ahead of him, and he could be a very kind of...
he could be a four-time Olympian.
Yeah, he could be a very, and it could be one of the most very important figure in our sport going forward.
You hope giving guys like this bit of profile gets them noticed and maybe more support, you know, and that's what you're looking for. And Mark, like, you talk, how Mark wasn't nominated for the Journalism Awards, I have no idea. I have my doubts about how they're... I know Kieran Cunningham was talking about that as well, but he goes after these type of things. He just constantly produces them. He's brilliant.
Yeah. Page 62 and 63 of the Mail on Sunday, we'll be seeing Jack Woolley come Tokyo 2020. By the way, taekwondo, it's Korean martial art. I like that this was in the corner because, I mean, I know taekwondo, but I don't know taekwondo is the point. Taekwondo, Korean martial art, emphasizes kicking, originated in Seoul shortly after the Second World War. It's been an Olympic sport since 2000. You're fully padded as fighters. The head and the body are the legitimate targets. All kicks are scored electronically. Fighters wear special sensor socks to check when they've landed kicks. So they have 3 2-minute rounds. Kicks to the body score 1 point. Kicks to the head score 3 points. And my favorite bit, if kicks are done with a spinning technique, the fighter gets an extra 2 points.
Yeah. Makes you want to watch it, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. Punches to the body score a point.
Like there is so much in it again, and it's not going to take away from anyone reading it, but again, another line, and it goes back to a kind of the stereotypes, and he says, like, people assume a lot about you when you're given a label. They'll say you're very flamboyant or whatever, but the thing is, I kick people for a living.
Yeah, that's a great line. That's a
good line. I'm going to come to Manchester United and Manchester City in a moment, because I know if I start you on those, then we may never get off them, David Snaith. So I'm jumping to GAA for a moment. Desi Farrell... is in the papers. Jack Anderson, by the way, has a really good piece on Colin McShane. I thought this was very informative because none of us are exactly sure what might face Jack or what might face Colin McShane when he goes over to Australia. So Jack Anderson is based over in Melbourne.
Yeah.
He's a director of sports law studies at Melbourne Law School. There's lots of GAA in the papers today. We'll come to Colm O'Rourke, by the way, who is actually saying that semi-professionalism, we are now at a point in the game where semi-professionalism would be a better idea than what we have now. So he says, someday we could have Google North Dublin against Facebook Dunleary wrapped down. Now, I thought initially he might have been joking when I read that line, but actually he's deadly serious. Mm. Come to that in a second. GAA fixture Farrago is sparking a bigger player drain than lure of the AFL. This is Jack Anderson, and he's obviously making the point that, frankly, it's the shambles that is the GAA fixture list which makes the AFL very tempting as much as the lifestyle over in Australia. He's saying, here in Melbourne, heart of AFL, there's been very little interest or coverage in Colin McShane, given the bushfires and given the Australian Open. But he says, where we are at the moment in Australia, 17 Irishmen are on the AFL clubs list in 2020, and there are 18 Irish women playing in the AFLW competition, which starts next month. So he says, ironically, given the connections between the two islands, there are now almost as many Irish players in the AFL as there are Tasmanians in the league. And he talks about the equal distribution of broadcast money, American-style draft system as well, where the league's least successful team in one season gets first choice on young talent in the next, and there's a salary cap. So he says McShane is going to, given the powerful players' union, he's going to get about $80,000 Australian dollars a year with limited potential for bonuses. The important point, he says, though, is that rookie salaries are not part of the salary cap. So rookies are less expensive than official draft pick. If you pick somebody through the official draft, that's going to cost you a $100,000 base salary and more than $4,000 for a senior match. So obviously, if you pay $80,000 to McShane, it's much cheaper and it doesn't affect your salary cap. Hence, he says, in a commercial sense, the Irish players are a low-risk, high-return investment for AFL clubs. McShane will likely be sent to the Development League in South Australia to see if he can make it to Adelaide senior list. If not, he'll be cut. And that is a good summary of why they've gone after someone like McShane. They have to pay him less, doesn't affect their salary cap as well, and they don't lose all that much either. If he doesn't make it in this lower league, then he'll just be cut, simple as.
Yeah, like it's a very good piece. It's very informative. Shane McGrath's talking about it as well, and he's a good piece. And I think the Colmar Rook piece is related to it. Like as you outlined there, it just makes sense from an Australian point of view, and it's a no-brainer from an Irish point of view. And even even Jack's last paragraph, every game that Colin McShane could potentially play for his AFL club in 2020 has already been scheduled and fixed. Could you say the same at home?
It's a no-brainer for McShane.
You're getting money. You're getting money to do what you're doing at home, and there's a structure to it. There's a sense to it, there's a coherency to it that's missing. Like, is it 60 players have gone?
Officially.
What do they expect? You know, I mean, and that. This goes back to Colm O'Rourke saying bringing semi-professionalism, but...
So explain this. So Colm O'Rourke, and so that's Jack Anderson's piece is very, very good. It doesn't
really good.
Bear much analysis, but he really lays out why the AFL teams go for Irish players and has all the facts and figures. Over on page 9, Colm O'Rourke has been a long-time critic of where the game is, but I've missed the few steps in between him saying we need to fix things as they currently stand and jumping all the way towards advocating almost semi-professionalism, tearing up the county system, having maybe 3 or 4 teams in Dublin.
I think it's great. Like, I love Colin's where, like, you try and do it, and they'd be the same, where if you're giving out about something, well, give me a solution. Like, this is a bit mad. Like, it's a bit crazy, but I love it, you know? Like,
Google North Dublin against Facebook Dunleary Rattown.
Like,
that sounds like the worst possible conclusion.
He teases it up. He says, players are not fools. They realise the league is a competition where they can make some progress, but the championship is a dead duck. Mickey Hart has been given out of the McShane thing, the Tyrone boss. Does Hart or any of the others who complain about players going to Australia have any feelings for this much larger group?
Yes.
So that's kind of tease it up.
And yeah, he's saying we're all talking about McShane going to Australia as if it's the big problem. The actual problem is all the players walking away from the game.
Yeah. And he's advocating, he's not saying it's going to happen, or like he's throwing it out.
Sorry,
there.
Hugh, it's absolutely not going to happen.
No, it's not. But to base on the AFL model, and he goes into the detail of that. But like, money has to come into it. It has to, and it's there already under the counter, maybe, or you know, through expenses or whatever. But the county system can't work in a professional arena. So he's suggesting there's a 12 to 14
teams,
franchises, which is just mad. Like, so you'd have, you know, two in Dublin, is it?
And he says the GAA could have a semi-professional league based on this model. County teams would disappear. He says we'd have 12 or 14 teams. They'd all play each other during the season. Naturally, there'd be at least one Dublin side, maybe 2 or 3. One in Kerry, Mayo, Galway, Tyrone, other centres where a team could be supported. The reality would be 50 or 60 players in Dublin would be snapped up. He obviously says all the players that play now couldn't be supported, but 50, 60 alone in Dublin would be snapped up. Perhaps the final someday could be Google North Dublin against Facebook and Leary Rattown, or it could still be Meath against Kerry. He says the type of league has many advantages. First of all, it would remove teams from under the auspices of county boards and save counties a fortune. He talks about the money wasted in the county game, that 95% of the money would go back into the game. He says the hassle over conflicts with the third level under 20s, other competitions would instantly disappear and young players would strive to get into the big league. For Manny, he says the thought of such a move is heresy. But he says we now have a system where the rich have nearly devoured the poor. I would still prefer a heavily reformed GAA to this semi-professional model, but, he says of the semi-professional model, it would be better than what we have at present.
He's talking about a franchise. He's talking about the IPL, you know, the Indian 2020 thing. Yeah. So you could have a guy, I don't know, Conor Callaghan playing for, you know, the Cork Tigers or whatever, you know, like it'd just be, or like American football, it would just be franchises.
The Elvery's Eagles in Mayo.
I love this kind of stuff because you start, and these are the type of conversations that have to be had for stuff to change. Like, as you said, it's not going to happen. But I mean, you know, the problem is the counties. You know, we have 32 counties. Each one has a different accent, which is nuts considering the size of the country. You know, which is like a 20 the size of Texas, where they all speak the same accent. But you know, it's defining, and the GA is the defining thing that separates it. They'll never go away from that. It's just how to work it out. But I love this type of, you know, speculation and stuff. I think it's a really good read, very interesting, entertaining read.
When you tie it in with what you're saying about the rest of the stuff, about players just walking away from inter-county football, and like, it's just, like, it's in a bad place. Is GA in a bad place here at the moment, where there's just a total like you're saying there about a disconnect with Munster, where there's just a total disconnect between the top of the game in terms of inter-county teams and the club teams. And like I have mates who would play for small enough clubs, like say around Blanchardstown and stuff, and like these lads give their lives to their club, like, and they know they're never gonna get near Croke Park unless they're on the hill watching the Dubs, whatever. And it just there just seems to be a major disconnect. And then like there's Mick Foley on page 9 is talking about kind of players need reasons to stay. And like the intro to it is very good, where he just says like maybe the most worrying thing for the GAA in the explanations for the mounting number of sabbaticals being taken by inter-county players this winter was the absence anywhere of a rebellion. Excuse me. Normally people are, like players are walking away because they feel as if they've got no other choice.
Yeah.
Like when Mick makes a point, he says like their decisions are personal and based on personal need, not a selfless gesture of defiance against a dysfunctional system. Whatever competition structure exists, the same root problems would exist. That's the message from the last few weeks everyone needs to hear, and where all attention should be focused. And then you go down to the last paragraph, which sums it up really. In amateur sport, no matter how souped up Gaelic games might appear, players will always come and go. Creating an environment that makes them feel good about staying is the challenge. And obviously he mentions that there's the player here, the Antrim hurler Simon McCrory, who talks about his reasons for walking away. And like, I know obviously you're talking about loving that, the wackiness of Colm O'Rourke's, but it's a serious issue for that the GAA have to.
But money has to come into it.
McCrory said, by the way, seeing as you mentioned his reasons, he was talking with the Irish News this week. He said, I can only speak, and this is like a player which doesn't make a massive headline, you know, really. It's not like somebody that you're likely to see on a billboard as you drive through town. I can only speak from experience. Being an inter-county player has put a strain on my family life and any relationship I've been involved in, because you barely see each other. I worry about the support that counties give to players in terms of where they're going. And he's decided to step away.
Like this, it feels at odds with what the whole point of, like you hear about this, the great Gaelic games, but the community and all the rest of it. He's clearly making the point, excuse me, that it's actually impacting on his life. So rather than being a positive focus of his life, it's actually having a very detrimental and negative.
Yeah.
And so surely like that's the start. Something like that is what the top brass in the GAA should be looking at and saying, no, this.
But if he was given proper compensation with that change, I mean, you were saying outside that, you know, these guys must be looking around at nutritionists, conditioning coaches who are all got on a wage, and then
managers and contracts.
Like it's been around for years, but if you were getting, if the system could be worked out to compensate from the top down, an equitable wage, would it keep players?
I don't know if it's just about giving them a wage. It's what Mick says here at the end. It's just about creating that environment that makes them feel good about staying. So like.
Yeah.
Maybe Gaelic Games, it's not about your profession and that's your job, but it can't be to the detriment of your life where you have to put things on hold.
But I would worry, so say we all say, okay, let's give them a wage.
Yeah.
So how much money is actually in the game is a worry. Like our lads who are, you know, there was a recent ESRI study and
more of a gulf.
60-70% of inter-county players have gone to university, which is much higher than the average person in the street. So how much money are you going to offer these fellas? Like realistically, so are you going to expect very intelligent young inter-county players to almost, I mean, if they're sacrificing their career now, they'd completely have to sacrifice it if they're being paid a few quid. So here's 300 or 400 or 500 quid a week and you need to put your life on hold for us. That's not a good solution.
That's what happened in rugby initially.
Yeah.
There's match fees and stuff like that, you know.
But like, there's.
You have to start somewhere, you know.
But I mean, how many.
Give people the option, you know. I mean, they're putting so much time into it if they want to.
But you see, the thing about rugby is that 80 or 90% of the revenues come from, say, Six Nations games and huge amount of sponsorship money. I mean, I'm not sure that's there to fund 200 players around the country. Like, you are getting rid of the county system then if you're going that route. You're paying them 500, 600, 700, 800
quid a
week.
Do you have to get rid of the county system? Could you have a central fund and...
They're throwing a lot of money then. Like, to justify... to justify these fellas giving up their work to play for their county.
Yeah.
Like, I just think we better be careful what we wish for here, because you're not going to pay them much money.
Are we not edging closer and closer with each piece like this? You know, like it has to be. These things have to be discussed now.
But these are issues again. Just from the outside looking at, you have always been here in the last number of years that people are talking about this constantly.
Yeah.
So you mentioned there about like no GAA player of you said, "Oh, we give you 300 or 400 quid a week, and that's your job."
Mm.
Like Lee Chien walk away. He kind of.
He's a full-time athlete.
Effectively. Like, whereas I just don't think it's not going to be feasible. Like,
no, it's a bad idea.
The Gaelic Games is it's a great sport on Air Ireland, but it's surely it's not going to be.
I don't know, because I have a lot of sympathy. I have a lot of sympathy for the GAA, because what do you do when, for 6, 7, 8, 9 years of a player's life in his 20s, it is the most important thing to him, and you have the Kieran McGeaney types in the world who want to sacrifice everything, who want to eat perfectly, who, like, this to win an All-Ireland for them is the most important thing for that 7, 8, 9 year window, and they want to train 6 days a week. Mm. How can you facilitate the Kieran McGeaney types who will put their GAA ahead of everything versus somebody who's saying, oh, well, I want a sense of well-being and I want to train twice a week?
Yeah.
I don't know how you mix all that in and
can
make
anyone
that
compatible. Do that anymore at the top level?
Probably not. There's enough Kieran McGeaney's there to sustain.
Are there people getting up, going to work, teams, going to the gym, then going to work 9 to 5, then going training 6 days a week? I mean,
probably.
Yeah.
So what do you do if you're a very good player but you turn around to your teammates and you say, look, you guys want to train before work and train after work and do this for 4, 5, 6 days a week? I can't. I'll train Tuesday, Thursday, and I'll go to gym once a week. Can I do that? And then you can't have different people in a team doing different things.
And
there's always, it seems, there's always going to be just about enough players by the looks of things who are willing to make the sacrifices, and then they reach a breaking point.
And they go to Australia.
Or they go to Australia, or they walk away from the game, or they just fall away from the inter-county scene because they have to prioritise their work. But unfortunately, you know, the foolhardiness of the foolishness of youth, there are enough lads who are 22, 23 who are willing to say, I'm going to make this the most important thing.
Though?
Like, well, I wonder, actually.
Because
I wonder.
The theme from all these pieces, from Shane and Colm and Jack, is that this ain't stopping anytime soon, you know, this drain, so.
Yeah. Well, when you're getting 2 matches a year, potentially, in the championship, it's not much of
that's
a carrot.
That's what some of the times is so bizarre about this, is that, like...
it's for 2 games a year.
Yeah, like, but, again, like, but it seems like the horse is bolting this like years. Like, the lads are effectively professional, like, and they are, like, as you say, like, lads are willing to do it, and... Some people don't want to do it, well, fair enough, they walk away. And eventually, though, maybe kind of, if you get enough lads who actually say, well, do you know what, it's just actually not worth the hassle. Mm.
What is a bit crazy, though, Dave, is that, like I think in the Dublin match yesterday, Desi Farrell's first game in charge, he picked a team of Farrell's fledgings, they were calling them, because the squad were on holiday in Bali. But the lads been training since November, isn't there? Like, they've started that for the 2 games a year 8 months later. I mean, maybe you should look at that as well. Mm. You know, are you breaking people too much with that kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah, poor Joyce was on.
Start in January. Like.
Poor Joyce was on recently and said there's just no need to be training in November to peak for a game in May.
Yeah, it's crazy. And when did that become the way to do things? Who decided
since
that?
A new manager came in and had a meeting with a bunch of very eager 23-year-olds in the main and said, lads, will we give this an unbelievable shot? We will. Right, brilliant. And then, you know, they do it for a few years and then the next batch come through and on you go.
Yeah.
You wanted to mention Desi Farrell gets a bit of attention. I mean, geez, for like an O'Byrne Cup January.
I was going to say...
Desi Farrell's got a little glimpse of the attention and scrutiny that's going to be on him.
Match reports of this game, but it's obviously not just match reports, it's kind of detailing the nature of, obviously, Desi Farrell now taking on this job. Mm. Gordon Manning in the Sun, obviously Roy Curtis in the Sunday World, and Michael Foley in the Sunday Times. It's just there's just great lines from different parts, like, fairness, like you mentioned, the Wolf Tones, the Blackened Hands, the ROIC, you've got Stormont mentioned, you've got, obviously, some of the lines, you've got Wolverine mentioned here by Roy Curtis, yeah. There's just some great lines in it, but it's like what you were tying into earlier. It's like, even like, obviously the Dubs, basically the lads who won the All-Ireland again were off in Bali, and it's effectively a D&E team by Longford, and they only lost by a couple of points in the a couple of points that were scored in the last couple of minutes, but there was a good line from Michael which sort of sums it up, where he says, when nearly all his players traipsed and back from Bali, Farrell fielded a team that made him the most recognisable Dub in the ground. And then, like, Gordon Manning's intro was pretty good. It's like, trouble between opposing factions, police restoring calm, and a return to power of a familiar face. No, not the Stormont Assembly, but Desi Farrell's first game in charge of the Dublin senior footballers.
And it does seem like Mick Foley touches on this as well. A Dub supporter picking fist fights with the locals and ranting about black and tans on the terrace.
It's been that kind of week, hasn't it?
And the referee running a gauntlet of Dublin supporters as he left the field, irritated by a handful of frees that granted a Longford passage to the O'Byrne Cup final. Much forever once more. It seems like it was a feisty enough.
But it's interesting how you talk about, there's a bit of a team here with managers and Desi Farrell now, it's going to be interesting to see what he actually does. Like, Roy Curtis obviously knows him, and he kind of, there's good lines here where he says, like, he's a natural born competitor, one who captained both the Dublin football and Irish hockey team within months of surgeons taking one look at his busted knee and delivering the forlorn prognosis that his sporting career was over. And then there's a quote from him where he says, I've always taken the approach that there's two ways to live your life. One, as a timid soul, sort of year by year, month by month, week by week, possibly even hour by hour, as a timid soul. Or the other is to perhaps do the thing that frightens you at times. That's this thing that stimulates me. It challenges me. So, like, I was listening to a podcast during the week where Jamie Carragher and Steven Gerrard, and very good. It was actually didn't think I'd be giving a plug for Jamie Carragher's podcast, but it's great about just properly getting into talking about football. But he had Gerrard on, and he was talking about, is it easier to come in as a manager when the shit has hit the fan a little bit and you're going to get a bit of time, or at the top where you're expected to just continue the dominance? So that's what's going to be interesting there with Desi Farrell, is like, what's he going to, he can't just do what Jim Gavin done. He's his own man, he's going to do his own things, but does he just make little tweaks here and there? Does he try and just keep things going and have that kind of consistency? Because from looking on the outside again, like, you don't think that needs to actually change.
It is.
Like, he has to put his own stamp on it at the same time. So, like, this game, in effect, doesn't matter. He actually says himself, I'm actually relieved to be out of this, so now he can get to work. But it's when all these other lads come back, and, like, I don't know when he'll begin to really mould his own squad. But that aspect of, you're talking earlier about, say, the identity, all these players who will be used to what Jim has done. But he has to bring in his own people a little bit who will buy into what he wants to do. He has to get these fellas to buy into what he wants to do. And, like, he can't really, I know he's lost this game, but there's going to be, like, they're going to be playing Kerry in the league soon, aren't they? So there's going to be big questions straight away, and he has to be able to just keep the show on the road, because there's a generation of Dublin supporters who are just so used to success.
And they were obviously cranky yesterday. But, like, one thing that lost in the mix is actually, it's a hell of a win for Longford, isn't it? I mean, is that a Mickey Mouse competition, whatever. But what Dave says is interesting, because, like, ultimately, this game doesn't really matter, right? It was a 23 substitutions.
Yeah.
Team Young for this, you know, so what? But in the climate of change, maybe just a whiff of uncertainty around Dublin, do you know, it just kind of adds to the little, maybe they're not as impregnable as they were with Jim Gavin gone. Mm. So, you know, I think I don't think he'd be thrilled to have lost first up, regardless of the circumstances.
It's curious, but, like, again, like, Mick Foley in the Sunday Times says, like, Farrell must now be Dublin's Peter, the rock on which Dublin must build a long-lasting church, hoping to avoid crucifixion. Where Gavin's final year was dedicated largely to getting one last squeeze from an incredibly talented and highly decorated panel, Farrell knows change must happen. So, like, there's obviously, maybe there are bigger issues lurking beneath with Dublin that need to be addressed. But it's like, again, with Man United, when Ferguson finished up and then David Moyes comes in, you start thinking, well, just carry it on. Like, they'd won the league with 12 points. Mm. The great Liverpool team back in the day, again, with Kenny Dalglish, but then they just fall off a cliff. Like, yeah, surely I can't imagine something like I don't think the pool of rivals is quite the same in terms of in Gaelic games, because most of them are obviously fecking off to Australia. But, like, it's going to be interesting, though, just to see if, like, the Dubs are that force whereby just teams are the fear factor. Like, would players all of a sudden say, yeah, Dublin are there for the taking just because Jim Gavin isn't there? You would have always thought it was just that. The whole point is that they have such a depth of talent, but how much does the actual manager then create that sense of just impenetrable kind of success? Because you looked at, even though it was obviously tight games, but has anyone really properly ever said, yeah, they're definitely good, they've got the beatings in Dublin? Like, is there a team now, like, I'm asking, I don't know, like.
No, there hasn't been a game Dublin have gone in not as favourites.
Yeah, but will that happen now, like, do you think?
No.
Okay.
Not yet.
No.
See, I
think it'll be a surprise when it happens, if it happens this year still. Maybe surprise is too strong a word, but.
So it could be interesting to see what happens now in terms of.
Oh, it's going to be fascinating. Yeah, it's going to be brilliant. Before we wrap things up, a few bits of football coverage that we wanted to touch on. So a piece which caught your eye, caught my eye as well, actually, is Jonathan Northcroft on page 5 of the Sunday Times.
Oh, yeah.
It's Sergio Aguero.
Yeah, Sergio.
It's kind of interesting. So, like, he's talking about how this evening at the Savoy, the Football Writers Association are going to have an annual tribute awards gala dinner type thingy for Vincent Kompany. And he was saying one player who'll probably never, ever get that is Sergio Aguero. Basically, and I was kind of unaware of this, I think a lot of people were, if Aguero scores against Aston Villa today, or when he scores his next goal, he's going to overtake Thierry Henry which many people thought would be impossible, really, as the most prolific foreign scorer in English top flight football. Aguero's got 174 Premier League goals for City. Henry's got 175 in slightly fewer appearances. 254 to Henry's 258. So it's not like he's just played more games. Man. He has really kept pace with Henry. And he was drawn, you know, further in the comparison. Henry has been the Football Writers Association Player of the Year 3 times and was the first to be the PFA Player of the Year in consecutive years. Aguero has, well, he's never been PFA Player of the Year, and he's only scraped on to the PFA Team of the Year twice.
That's which is surprising.
A bit surprising, I have to say, yeah. He's both appreciated, but also underappreciated, Aguero.
Yeah, it's like, and Jonathan Norcoff makes the point, he says he kind of, maybe his issue is he's simply too efficient, too monotonously good. He's the Novak Djokovic of the Premier League, the industrial achiever for whom love is begrudged. And like, obviously, if you can't really compare, obviously, Henry with Aguero, because they're two completely different players. Aguero is purely a poacher, isn't he? Like, he's, like, there was talk, remember when Guardiola came in, that he was going to, they brought in Gabriel Jesus, and it looked as if Aguero was going to be on the way out. And that's maybe another indication of just how good he is, where he actually was able to say, he was able to kind of make Guardiola realise, well, actually, I need Aguero. Like, for all the pressing, and he does do it, but Guardiola realised, actually, I need Sergio Aguero. And like, when he would have came into the Premier League, you're sort of thinking, ah, he'll go there for the money for a couple of years, and then he'll go off to Barca or to Real Madrid. Mm. But he stayed, and obviously he's been well compensated, he's been successful. There's an argument that he's probably one of City's greatest ever players.
I think Alan Shearer was derided recently for saying that Aguero is the best foreign player in the history of the Premier League, and basically I saw nobody agree with that. Opta talks about the Henry comparison. He's scored more goals as well with his wrong foot, more headers, more goals away from home. Talks about goals in big games. So he scored 9 against Man United, 7 against Liverpool, 11 against Chelsea. He's never been an Eden Dzeko, fattening his account with the 4th and 5th goal in a 5-0 romp.
And as well, if he hadn't been playing during the week, he probably could have had a double that tally against United.
Yeah.
Because he would have had a field day. But obviously you're comparing with Henry because he's currently at the top of the list. They are two completely different players. But I just think even his effect and his impact on City, I'd say him and like obviously Yaya Toure, like not so much obviously there's the goals, but a player of that caliber who's just stood around or stayed around, and that's what's helped kind of keep City at that level as well. Obviously they brought in Guardiola and stuff, but like when you have a player like that, that's what keeps you at that level in terms of like not just going for the money a couple of years and then going to a Madrid.
Yeah.
So like that's been key, and like, but it's very interesting though is the fact that. Like, so not so much say Football Writers, because I don't think you'd be too fussed if you get an award from the journalists. I don't think they are really, but it is still interesting that maybe his own players haven't sort of
recognized
him. I'd imagine he would have lost out the year when Van Persie single-handedly won United the league in Ferguson's last year. And but then like that moment is in the Aguero moment, the Martin Tyler. It's just been an incredible career. He will obviously he's gonna break that record, and then you just think. If he wins the Champions League, if he's going to be helping win the Champions League this year, that would just put him on a completely different level. And like, I don't think he's the best. Was it what did Shearer say? Best foreign player in the? I still don't think so. He's probably the best in terms of a striker. If he scores the most goals, you have to put him up there. But you look at some players who kind of transformed the Premier League. I don't think he's sort of done that. Like, you know what I mean? Like in the last couple of years, it's been some more so managers who've done that. Like Guardiola and Klopp have.
Yeah.
They're the ones who have done that. You know.
He's the most under the radar 174 Premier League goals striker.
He's finish. Far too old for highlights, though.
Uh-huh.
He's far too old for highlights.
That's the key point, of course. Just before we wrap this up, Klopp coming against us. Just to mention Jonathan Wilson. We don't have to labour this point at all because it's a fairly digestible one. Basically, he's talking about City during the week against Man United, and he was saying there is, you know, a perception City aren't at it this year, and maybe they've lost some of their edge. So he's looked at the stats, and if you're under the impression that City just aren't quite working as well or working as hard this year, he says the stats belie that. In every metric to gauge pressing this year offered by Opta, high turnovers, press sequences, opposition passes allowed per defensive action, how high up the pitch a team begins open play sequences, City are as good, if not better, than last season. So actually, Wilson's conclusion is, it may really just be as simple this year as they lost a central defender in Company, then the injury happened, and then they're stuck with Otamendi and John Stones, and the thing has sort of fallen apart. So if you look at City in most ways, most metrics, they are working just as hard this year. This isn't a team that under Guardiola and his intense ways have fallen off ever so slightly. And he makes the argument they'll be back next year. Plus Liverpool are phenomenal, which that's makes things difficult.
But that's the guilt of it. Like Liverpool are just on a different level at the moment in terms of their consistency. And like Liverpool have been able to deal with their injuries a little bit better than City. Like I know they've obviously lost Company, but losing Laporte as well was huge.
As soon as Laporte was injured, you worried for them. Liverpool just haven't let up. Now, clock is really against us. Man United then. So there's two aspects here. There's Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, which I know you have in front of you, Hugh.
Yeah.
And then just
it's itching to talk about it.
I know you are. It's a good piece on page five. It's a small piece. Jonathan Northcroft again here. But he's just talking about Ed Woodward and United and where they are. So basically, what is notable is that on Tuesday against Manchester City, I know it's Carabao Cup, but it's still Manchester City, that there were 7,000 empty seats. And that was despite a dumping of thousands of tickets on general sale after it became clear many season ticket holders were going to miss the match. They put tickets on sale for £66, which Northcroft says was larcenous so soon after Christmas. So it was a further signal to the Glazers and Woodward that they can no longer treat fans as cash cows. Talks about how the average gate at Old Trafford last season was 74,000. That was the lowest figure since 2009-10. It's going to be lower again this year, 73,000 on average. As few as 50,000 turned up for that Astana match. And he was saying as well this week, Liverpool announced a new kit agreement with Nike. It's set to eclipse United's record Adidas deal. Another gut punch to the Glazers. So it seems that the frailties on the pitch are now starting, at last it seems, to manifest themselves away from the pitch. Because for the last couple of years, Ed Woodward was justifying his £3 million salary by saying, well, we're making more money than everybody else. And it was even saying here, profits have lagged now behind Spurs' 112 million and Liverpool's 98 million last year. So away from the pitch, United are starting to suffer financially, which you feel was always going to happen. There were a few get Ole Gunnar Solskjaer out pieces, including you have Eamon Sweeney there, do you?
Yeah, Tommy Conlon's on it as well, and there's a theme across the papers. I suspect these were written after the City game because obviously they won 4-0 yesterday. So, you know, that happens.
It wouldn't strike you as the time to write this. Solskjaer must go the 4-0.
No. And look, Tommy and Eamon are excellent columnists. Like, the key is, like, if you really calm, you want to come out, you know, with it registered in your head. And Eamon certainly does that. I just have an issue. Like, the way he writes, you zip through it as ever. He's a very good writer, but I have an issue with the content. I just think it's...
What's he arguing?
I just think it's way over the top. Like, he goes in straight off, nobody really believes Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is the man for the job at Old Trafford. So straight away, like, you're there. And then he compares him variously to Lance Armstrong. Sticking with him is like, he compares him to John Terry sleeping with Wayne Bridge's wife. And then he compares him to Count Dracula, like he calls him the undead. Do you know? Like, I just think.
And now, hang on. In fairness, he doesn't compare him with John Terry
Wayne Bridge's wife.
Let's be fair to him.
That was confusing.
yeah, to say the least.
I wasn't saying that. But insisting that Solskjaer should remain at the helm is like saying John Terry should have been sacked as England captain for sleeping with Wayne Bridge's ex. One of those arguments which looks beyond silly down the line. I just think. No, like, as I said, that's what a column does. It gets you kind of wound up. So he does that very well.
Yeah.
Is it not just... No, just because... And he makes the point that, because Solskjaer is such a nice guy, baby-faced, all that stuff, that he's not getting the proper
criticism
that he deserves. But I just think... I mean, are they not producing Greenwood and young... You know, have they not the young fellas coming through that, like... He doesn't deserve a kicking like this soon. Dracula and Lance Armstrong, I would suggest.
Yeah.
I mean, the one again yesterday, but like, surely he deserves at least to get to another season, no?
By the way, because again, I just think in Eamon's defence, and there'll be listeners going, Lance Armstrong, what's happened here?
Oh yeah,
he's just making the point that it's a bit like the beginning of the end game in the Lance Armstrong
saga.
Sorry,
he's not implying he's a drugs cheater.
No, he's not. He's basically saying there's a sense that the end is nigh here, that this is not going to work out, and it's just a case of how long we suspend the inevitable. Hence the Armstrong.
He's done his job very well, Eamon. Like, you're kind of like gripped by it, but I just think it's a bit over the top.
You found your fist clenching as you read it, did you? Yeah. In defence of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. Are you a United fan?
No, I really like Solskjaer. I just really I liked him as a player, and I like watching him now. Mm-hmm. I like the way I like his accent. You know, that kind of Carnation Street thing he has going on, Scandinavian edge to it. But
like, Robbie Fowler makes a point in his column in the Sunday Mirror today, and it makes sense that he would discuss it because he would actually be able to relate to it a little bit.
Yeah,
it's like he's sort of coming in at the point whereby obviously Fowler was part of a Liverpool team in the early 90s that was very talented and was still being compared to Liverpool teams of the past when they had just been successful. And Solskjaer's doing that himself. You know, he's trying to create that link with supporters and the history of the club, and he's a United man and stuff. And that it does only get you so far, but because it's very similar to what Klopp done when he came in. Like, Klopp was derided when he was bringing the Liverpool team up in front of the Kop after drawing 2-2 away with West Brom and celebrating it. But his message was clear. It was kind of like he was trying to get that connection with supporters. And I don't think Solskjaer doesn't seem to be on the level of a Klopp in terms of maybe as a coach or a manager. But there can be sometimes a lot to be said at the moment with United in terms of having that connection with supporters and bringing those players through. And it's interesting here, yesterday United went 3-0 up and the fans weren't singing about against the manager, they were singing out against Woodward and the Glazers.
Yeah.
And there'd be a big sense with Solskjaer would be, like, he was very critical of Mourinho indirectly, where he just said the players weren't fit enough.
Mm.
And that's what he put last year when, remember, he had that great start, won like 16 out of 17 games, whatever, and then he just fell apart after pretty much after PSG away. So it'd be a big thing this year. I think it'd be a question mark going into next season if he is still there, is how he finished this season.
Yeah.
Like, you look at what happened during the week against City, and it was the first half was just atrocious, and then City just took the foot off the gas. If they finish the season strongly under Solskjaer, and actually, I don't know if they will get Champions League, but they're 4 or 5 points off Chelsea, but if they finish the season strongly and do grind out wins, that would be a sign of progress. You know, what, like, whether they win a cup or whatever, but it's going to be the end of this season. So what Eamon Sweeney is saying is correct in terms of, is there a sense of the end is now. If United don't finish the season strongly, well then that'll be a big black mark against Solskjaer, because he came in on the basis of, well, I'm going to have these players fit.
Mm.
I'm going to have these players firing and stuff. So they've been inconsistent, and part of that has been down to the fact that, like, again, it goes above them as well. Like, they knew they were going to be losing Ander Herrera. They never even replaced him. They knew they were going to be wanting to get rid of Matic, but he's still around. Fellaini was gone. Like, he has been ruthless though. Like, he's gotten rid of Chris Smalling. Like, he's put him out on loan. He's getting criticised for that. Like, he has Brandon Williams in there now at left back. It's just the problem is that Liverpool are so far ahead of United in every aspect.
And we're talking about United here as if they're plucky underdogs and not one of the world's richest teams.
They've got the highest wage bill in European football. You know what I mean? They've wasted so much money.
It definitely seems the club are of a mind to be loyal now, that they've chopped and changed manager and they've spent about £1 billion doing so. And it's almost like they've said, right, we need to at least stick with someone. We can't just have Van Gaal buying a bunch of players, then Mourinho buying a bunch of different players, and we end up with a mishmash.
Yeah.
But they've stumbled upon Solskjaer. They gave him the job. And around that time, they said, right, we really need to be loyal to this guy now. And Miguel Delaney was on with us during the week, and he said even after the City game, the sense in the club was, we're sticking by this guy.
Yeah.
The problem is they're sticking by an unknown quantity. Like, at least when Liverpool stuck by Klopp at the start, well, one, there were signs of definite progress, but two, what he had done at Dortmund was evidence and supported the notion that this guy is worth sticking by.
Yeah.
So even
he
if
had
things,
a body of work that you could believe
work.
In.
So if this gets patchy, let's just trust this guy that if we give him enough time, which no club does, the body of work at Dortmund and his general vibe suggests he will get this thing right eventually. Whereas United now are in this strange position where the one guy they've decided to be loyal to through even the thin parts, as well as the thick parts, through thick and thin, is a guy that they can't be sure of, that there's no body of evidence there to suggest they're doing
the right
thing.
So would you agree with Eamon towards the end of his piece where he says it's time to put Solskjaer out of his misery? He doesn't represent the club's tradition or its values.
I feel like it's incredibly harsh to do that, because Solskjaer has certainly not proven himself to be a bad manager yet. The thing that makes me think maybe they need to be ruthless is that Pochettino ain't hanging around forever, and he is in that elite category that, you know, if Pochettino came in within a year, United would be back finishing second or third very quickly and then pushing on.
Yeah.
But I do think sacking Solskjaer at this moment in time will be massively unpopular with fans around the club. Like, I don't think it will go down well at all. So it's a genuine dilemma.
The only feasible way at the moment that they could justify sacking Solskjaer is if the next day they announce Pochettino. Like you can't just sack him and then not have a plan.
Sorry, it has to be for Pochettino.
Yeah, well,
give or take.
Yeah, effectively.
Like they missed out on Klopp and they missed out on Guardiola.
And that's and Ferguson went for both, and Ferguson did speak to both of them people, but
I do feel it would still be very harsh. But I think Solskjaer would be saying, "Well, are you giving me a chance here or not?"
Yeah.
I wonder, is Eamon a United fan? Is he like
it's Sligo Rovers? I know.
Rovers, yeah. I know. Yeah. Like,
I don't know.
That's a good column. Like
if you look on, we can talk about this all day. With Solskjaer, like he's had to deal with the Pogba situation, where Pogba is effectively devil tilts.
Yes, difficult. Yeah.
Right, and there's elements there around the dressing room where when you read, because there's so many good lads covering the United beat. There's not much getting out about him not being popular with players or him not, like, you know what I mean? So it's just going to be, he has to deliver on the pitch. It's basic, it's as simple as that, but he needs backing. Like Woodward, he's actually in a slightly strong position, in the sense that Woodward has been, in terms of on the pitch, a disaster. So like he was the one who oversaw Moyes coming in, got rid of Moyes, brought in Van Gaal, got rid of Van Gaal literally within a day of winning the FA Cup. Gets Mourinho, sacks Mourinho, and now you look at the Woodward stuff as well, about he's the highest paid CEO, but they're still falling behind now off the pitch. Like Woodward, and there's another lad there who is, it's not just Woodward now, there's another lad there, Judge, I think his name is, I can't remember his first name, who he's heavily involved with. So again, it just comes back to, there's a lot of problems around Solskjaer. Well, I don't think Solskjaer by any means is the biggest problem, but so far I still don't think at the moment that you can't hang your hat on him to say, yeah, this is the fella who's definitely going to turn it around, because there's just so too many issues around the club that are going to hold them back at a time when City are on a completely different level, and at the moment Liverpool are even a level above that. And things can change quickly in football, but you don't see a change in any time soon with the standards whereby that Liverpool have set. And that's probably one of the worst things for United at the moment, is that it's their biggest rivals who are setting these standards and look as if they could be ready to dominate with City for the next 4-0
years. 4-0 isn't a bad place to be coming off. And like,
yeah, but that's down to those kids. The bottom team in the league. By the way, Adam Eda was starting up front for, which
he was. That's actually something, I know we're done time-wise, but it's good to see some positive on the Irish soccer thing.
No, it is. There seems to be a really good generation.
Kids, but like the FAI, you know, the
independent,
like,
directors.
Just a sense from the papers today of turning the corner, like Philip Quinn in the Mail and elsewhere. Like, it's just, it's nice to read.
Yeah, about long overdue.
Yeah.
We'll have to leave it there, fellas. David Snaid, football journalist, and Hugh Farley, the deputy head of sport at the Mail on Sunday and the Irish Daily Mail. Thanks so much.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.